Need one. Wave your hand there. Brother Spidle's got those to distribute this evening. All right, this evening's text is the 8th chapter of the book of Esther. You know what all's been going on. They've finally made it to the second of Esther's banquets with the king. Haman came with some hope that his day was going to get a little better. It had such a terrible, horrible, awful, no good, very bad day, whatever that is, huh? Call him Alexander. Anyway, but it got worse. When he got there, they had some drinks at least, and the king told Esther to tell me what it is you want. I'll give you whatever you want, whatever your request is, whatever your petition, up to half the kingdom, which is my petition and my requests that are for my life and for the lives of my people. And he said, who would dare do such a thing as to threaten the life of my queen and her family? And she says, this wicked Haman. And the king, in a rage, stormed out to walk through the palace garden for a minute to gather his thoughts. And Haman took that opportunity to fall on the queen and make a plea for his life. And the king came back in, saw what was happening there, and assumed he was assaulting the queen, or at least decided to read it that way, and pronounced the death sentence upon Haman and ordered his execution. One of the helpful servants there, who was one who we'd seen in chapter 1, who had some responsibility for the queen and the harem, made a very helpful suggestion. He says, Haman just built a scaffold, a spike 75 feet high, on which he intended to impale Mordecai this morning, and it's in his backyard. And the king says, hang him on it. All right. And that's where we stopped at the end of chapter 7. Now, chapter 8 opens. Let's have a word of prayer, and we'll get into the text of chapter 8. Father in heaven, we thank you for your work in the lives of your people, for how you show yourself strong, sometimes in spectacular ways and sometimes in subtle, hidden, quiet ways as you direct from behind the scenes, as you do in the account in Esther. And Lord, that is the way you typically work in our own lives, and we thank you for the reassurance that you are always there, always guiding, always directing, that your will may be done. Lord, may our hearts be encouraged through our study of your word this evening. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, chapter 8 opens. We see, first of all, impressive gifts. Impressive gifts in the first two verses of chapter 8. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. There's a lot of stuff going on in those two verses when you stop and think about it. A lot of important transactions occurring right there in those two verses. Now, exactly when all the events of chapter 8 occur isn't really clear. This chapter begins with the expression on that day, and so we know that that's referring to the day on which the banquet was held. They're still in the banquet room, apparently, there after having ordered Haman's execution, and we've seen the record that that was done. Well, they're still there. It seems evident that that's where they are because it was toward the end of the day anyway. It was on that day, the day of the banquet, at which Queen Esther had made her plea and Haman had been executed. Now, it's possible, and I think probably likely, that all of the events described down through the middle of verse 10 occurred that night in that room. However, it's also possible that there was a gap of several hours or even days or even weeks between the opening clause of verse 1 and the second clause of verse 1. We don't know for a fact what happened next. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And it may be later that Mordecai was called before the king. We don't know when Esther revealed what he was to her. Many interpreters, commentators, understand it that way, there being a time gap. I'm inclined toward this happening very quickly. I'll explain why as I go. But the narrator hasn't provided a daily time log for us. You remember the last time he told us what day it was? It was in chapter 3 when he told us in verse 7 that it was the 13th day of the first month in the 12th year of the reign of King Ahasuerus, and that's when Haman concocted his scheme, right? When he decided what he cast lots to see when would be the best day to have the Jews killed, and then he goes to the king, and probably that day, and gets the king to sign off on writing the edict to have these troublesome people annihilated. And so that was 70 days ago, before we get another time marker, which we don't get until verse 9 of this chapter. We get another time marker on the 23rd day of the third month of that same year. So 70 days have transpired between those two events. How much of what's happened in the rest of chapters 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 occurred during that 70 days, we're not told. I think most of it. Most of those 70 days have been passed. I mean, they had to get the edict written. He had to get it dispatched. He had to get it communicated throughout all the kingdom. That didn't happen in, 28 minutes with email. It took some time. The Jews had to respond in anguish and with despair. Mordecai is despairing and outside in the courtyard in mourning. Esther sends word to find out what he's so upset about. He communicates with her. They talk about things. She finally agrees that she'll go in and see the king. They fast for 3 days. She goes to see the king. It's been another day since then. So several of those days, a lot of that time is already behind us. I think that's important to note because commentators sometimes wonder how come it took Mordecai so long to get something written. I don't think it took him very long at all. I think most of those 70 days have already passed by the time of the banquet. I think we're pretty close to this date by the time of the banquet. And in fact, that banquet may have been on that day. We don't know for sure, or the day before. That's mentioned in chapter 8, verse 9. So we don't have a time log. It's a little confusing as to, there's a little bit of latitude, I should say, a little bit of flexibility as to how much time passes for some of these events. Now, as I've said, both Persian and Greek sources, not to mention the Judeo-Roman source Josephus, attest that according to Persian law, the property of a condemned criminal becomes the property of the crown. It becomes the king's to do with as he sees fit. We saw that even in Hebrew history when back in the reign of Ahab in Israel, when he was lamenting the fact he couldn't get a hold of this one vineyard that he wanted. Jezebel went out and had the guy accused of a crime, had him killed, and then took possession. It became the property of the crown. We see here that when Haman is executed for having assaulted the queen, as the king interpreted it, the property becomes the king's. He can do what he wants with it. And so in this case, King Ahasuerus chose to give Haman's property to the queen. So immediately upon Haman's condemnation or his execution, Ahasuerus transferred ownership of Haman's property to Queen Esther. It says his house. That word does not mean his residence. It includes his residence, but it is not limited to the place he lived, the place where he built the scaffold. It includes all that, but it's not limited to that. The word means his entire estate, everybody pertaining to his house, all his servants, everything that was Haman's is now Esther's. There is reason to believe that his estate was probably substantial, especially if that 375 tons of silver was coming out of his money, right? Unless it was money he expected the king to earn, as that was a possible interpretation of that. But there's reason to suspect that his estate was large. It now all belongs to Queen Esther. Now, an interesting thing, sidebar on this, there is nothing in any of the annals of the Persians or the Greek records concerning the Persians that talks about any time that the king made such a bequest to his queen that made the queen independently wealthy. The queen was usually property of the king also, right? As he was able to take Vashti and then put her aside. He has just bequeathed to Esther an estate that would make her a rich woman should he ever decide to replace her. She is independently wealthy with this gift. There's no record that any Persian king, whether it ever happened before or not, we don't know. But it certainly didn't happen all the time. This was not something that was frequently done. This was a remarkable gift for him to do this, to turn it all over, to give it to Esther and gave her, when he gave her possession. The text doesn't say anything about why he did it. Maybe it was as compensation for the danger she'd endured. Maybe it was a reward for pointing out to the king what Haman had failed to mention about how much it would cost him to annihilate these people and what how much harm it would do to the kingdom if he were to have followed Haman's plan. So he gave all of that to Esther. That's the first of those remarkable gifts. The second one is he transferred possession of his signet to Mordecai. We sometimes think of Mordecai as the guy in the background who was, you know, he was in fact Esther's guardian. He was in fact the one who helped rear her when her parents had died. He was her cousin. But he was a lot more than that, and he becomes a lot more than that, as we will see as the narrative continues into chapter 9 and 10. But he transferred to Mordecai his own signet ring. That was the ring that he had had to recover from Haman. When they had to take it off of Haman's hand when they arrested him and took him away to be impaled, and now he's given it to Mordecai. That's a significant promotion. Mordecai had been... clearly, he's been working for the king for some time. He's been an official conducting the king's business at the palace gate. All of a sudden, he's prime minister or grand vizier with the authority now that Haman had possessed to write documents and seal them in the king's name. An incredible promotion for Mordecai. Now, it may be that the king called for Mordecai before he and Esther left the banquet hall. That's what I think is probably the best way to understand this. The grammar doesn't require that, that it happened as Esther explained to him who Mordecai was to him, because Mordecai came up, remember, in that conversation after the drinks when the king came back in, that scaffolding that had been erected for the execution of Mordecai the Jew. Mordecai came up there. And so Esther may have used that as the opportunity to say, King, you should know that Mordecai is my cousin and he's been my guardian. He reared me when my parents died. Somehow it doesn't say how she explains. She had disclosed what he was to her. She doesn't say when or anything, but probably still that night. I'm inclined to think that. Grammar didn't require it. It could have been later. The text also says that... we already know everybody knew Mordecai was a Jew. And what we have now is a situation where Esther has, by revealing her relationship to Mordecai, she has revealed she too is a Jew. Not yet been mentioned that the Jews were the target of Haman's scheme. Outside that wording of the edict that she just quoted and this king seemed never to have read. But we've now finally got the first clear indication of her Jewish heritage by her relationship to Mordecai. We don't know what all she has revealed. But this was, his promotion of Mordecai, though, should still not be thought of as just a favor to the queen. Mordecai has already demonstrated executive skill, or he wouldn't have had the job he had at the gate. The king doesn't have to wonder whether Mordecai would be susceptible to bribery, or maybe... disloyal to the king. He's already demonstrated that he was fearless in the face of Haman, and he was absolutely loyal to the king. The king just read about it last night, right? And has just rewarded Mordecai for that. Mordecai was courageous. He was loyal. And so if he's got an opening in the position of grand vizier, and he's already seen that Haman has been manipulating him, there's not a guy he can trust more than Mordecai. And so this wasn't just as a favor to the queen. This was Mordecai's merits, as you will. He had earned this respect from the king. Well, when the king then made Mordecai his grand vizier, we're also told that Esther transferred management of her new estate to Mordecai. It's hers, but she puts him in charge of running it. Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. What an ironic turn of events in such a short time. Just the night before, Haman had gone home complaining about Mordecai, and his wife and friends had talked him into building that scaffolding and get rid of him before dinner so he can enjoy dinner. Things didn't quite turn out that way. So now Mordecai is in charge of Haman's whole estate. Now that would be the happy ending of the story. Story of palace intrigue, the triumph of a young Jewess over an adversary. The next verse kind of jolts us back to remembering that there's more going on in this story. This is not a story just about Esther. The doomsday timer that Haman had set for the destruction of the Jews has not been disarmed by these events. That date is still approaching, and it is quite literally a deadline, right? When Israel will be annihilated. The estates, the titles that have been transferred to Esther and to Mordecai may well save their lives, because it wouldn't take much to lock them away somewhere safe on that date so that nobody could be there to, could threaten them. Mordecai now has the authority to organize whatever security measures he might want and to post them outside whatever room they're in, because the threat is only a 24-hour threat, correct? So it might actually save their lives. It wouldn't do anything for the rest of the Jews. And so the problem still exists. And so we find still in verses 3 through 8 the impending danger. In verses 3 through 6, Esther reminded the king that the danger was not past. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the golden scepter to Esther, so Esther arose and stood before the king. Then she said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all of the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people, and how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" Now, many believe that this all occurred on a later date, that she presented herself to the king a second time unannounced, hoping that his earlier clemency would be repeated, the time that he had welcomed her before. They base that on the fact that he extended his scepter to her for the second time. That's possible, but the text doesn't say anything about him having to return to the throne room or of her having to come in to present herself another time at risk of her life. I suspect that what happened is, for the very first time in anywhere in this narrative, Esther spoke to the king without being asked a question. She spoke. As I said before, I think that the protocol was that very likely what I think is implied in the way it's all presented is protocol required nobody speak to the king until he addresses them, unless you're one of his bodyguards. And it's all in the context of the execution of Haman there, for instance. There were a few executives who had the right to come into the throne room unannounced. They would have had that privilege. Not so Esther. She spoke. She was clearly deeply distressed. There are three verbs that indicate that. She fell, she wept, she implored. She was deeply distressed. I suspect that what happened is she fell on her knees before him and began to speak. And his extending the scepter signified that he waived the penalty for speaking in his presence without having been addressed. I think it's probably best to understand them still there in the banquet hall. They've not left the place yet from where Haman had been dragged away. Location and timing really don't matter. But she begged the king then, when he gave her permission to speak, she begged him to avert the evil, that which Haman had devised against the Jews. To intervene in some way to prevent the annihilation of the Jews that Haman had decreed. She's now admitted who she is and what her ethnicity is. And she then, having made that plea from her knees before him, she rises and states it formally. She begins the formal request almost exactly the same way she did before when she made her petition before him. She just reverses the phrases, "if it please the king and if I have found favor before him." As she said those in the opposite order in chapter 7, verse 3. Then she adds another clause, "and if the matter seems proper to the king and I am pleasing in his sight." It's a little bit of trivia here. The word translated proper, this is the first time this word shows up in the Old Testament. It's a fairly obscure Hebrew word prior to this time. And it may be, because Esther used the word in this context, that it will become the most commonly used word in later Jewish literature to refer to something that is approved under Jewish law. The old Hebrew pronunciation is slightly different than the way it's pronounced today, but today you'd pronounce the word kosher. Okay. If it's kosher to the king, if it's proper to the king. I just thought that was interesting that the word shows up here in this verse for the very first time in the Old Testament and in this context. If the matter seems kosher to the king, and if I am pleasing in his sight. She asked, thirdly, for an edict revoking the edict that had been devised by Haman. Clearly, she's learned a few things about diplomacy in her 5 years as queen. For one thing, she doesn't mention that the letters to which she's referring were a problem only because they bore the king's seal. Okay, this is what Haman did. I'm acknowledging Haman's the one who wrote those. I'm acknowledging he was the one who had your signet. I'm not bringing the king up at all. She doesn't even mention the king's responsibility in any of this. However much blame the king ought to bear because of his carelessness, his inattention to detail, if you will, she assigns all the blame to Haman. It was his hatred, his schemes, his letters. And then she asks, how can I endure? How can I go on living if I see the calamity which is going to befall my people and see the destruction of my kindred? She states twice, how can I endure? How can I endure? She expressed unendurable grief if her people are slaughtered. King, this isn't just about me. If I survive, she implies that she assumes the king is going to spare her and spare Mordecai. But why bother if her people are annihilated? I don't even want to go on living, King. King Ahasuerus, if my people are annihilated. She wants the king to understand that this is personal. She doesn't even want to survive if they are going to die. You understand there are some ways in which her actions prefigure the work of Christ. The text doesn't make this explicit. The New Testament doesn't point to her as a type of Christ, but there are a few examples that resemble Christ's work so completely, as does Esther's here. This is not a story of Esther looking out for Esther and the Jews benefiting by what was good for her. This is an account of Esther sacrificially offering herself in defense of her people and being elevated to a position of glory through her sacrifice. Is that not very much what Christ did in his giving himself for his people? There is certainly a Christ-like spirit displayed by Esther here at this point. Well, the king, in verses 7 and 8, commanded them to write a new decree in verses 7 and 8. So King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring, for a decree which is written in my name in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked." Now the reminder of Haman's execution and the gifts he's given to Esther and Mordecai, that statement is thought by many to indicate this passage. This indicates a passage of time and a change of venue. They're no longer in the banquet hall, and he's bringing this up again. Most of them who say so, most commentators interpret it that way, say that what he's doing here is reminding Esther, I've already done a lot for you. I've already given you a lot. Now I'm going out and going to give you even more. I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's the next logical step. I think they're still in the banquet hall. Because you understand, if the king doesn't do what Esther asks here, his promise to do whatever she asks is still unfulfilled. She did not ask him for Haman's estate. When he said, "What is it you request? What is it you came to me at risk of your life to ask of me?" She didn't ask for him to hang Haman. She didn't ask him to give her Haman's estate. All of that was something he did because of Haman's actions that night. What she asked is for my life and for the lives of my people. If he doesn't do this, it leaves his promise to her unfulfilled. It leaves his debt to her unfulfilled, as it were, because he's made a formal pronouncement that he's going to give that, he's going to keep his word to her. Haman was his witness. Now, Haman's dead, but the king's a man of honor, it seems, and so he's going to keep his word. Restating this, I think, is for the purpose of the record. Let the record show what I'm about to give to Esther does not revoke what I've already done for her. What I've already done still stands. She owns Haman's property. Mordecai holds my signet. That's already done. This is the next thing I'm going to do, and this is my fulfillment of my promise to her. They can devise, Esther and Mordecai, you write the wording, you devise the wording, you seal it in the king's name. You two figure out what it is you need to say. Now, the final clause of verse 8 has a dual meaning. Yes, it means whatever they write in the king's name, sealed with the king's signet, cannot be revoked. It's a reminder, though, that what is already written and already sealed with the king's signet also cannot be revoked. They can't just write an edict that says, ignore the earlier edict. The slaughter of the Jews on the 13th of the 12th month is off. They can't write an edict that says that because that law can't be changed. It was irrevocable. Whatever you're going to do, you're going to have to figure out a way for a workaround. You can't just nullify it. It must. So that's how I worded it here. It must counteract without nullifying the former edict. You have to come up with an edict that will allow for the protection of the Jews without nullifying the order permitting their slaughter. How do you do that? Well, maybe they've already given it some thought. I don't know how long it took them to do this. Maybe they wrote it that night or wrote it overnight, or maybe it took them just a few days. But I find the solution ingenious, an ingenious solution. I am surprised by all the commentators who wonder why Mordecai waited until the 23rd day of the third month. One writer says that he was busy learning his responsibilities at court, so it took a while to get around to it. I don't think he let court responsibilities interfere with this task. And again, they're forgetting everything that happened in chapters 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 during that 70-day period. This didn't need to take very long. It was probably very close to the 23rd day of the third month by the time they had this banquet, as we look in verses 9 and 10 at this decree's preparation, its preparation. So the king's scribes were called at that time. In the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, the princes of the provinces, which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. Another little point of trivia. Verse 9 of chapter 8 is the longest verse in the Hagiographa, those books called the Writings. It includes the Book of Ruth, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Lamentations, and Daniel. This is the longest verse in all those books. Just a little point of trivia. The wording is parallel to a lot of the things that the earlier edict says. We'll see as this description goes on. It was written 70 days, number one, under letter A. Its preparation is letter A. Number one is it was written 70 days after Haman's edict. And I think it happened fairly quickly because it says it was at that time that they called them in to do this. It was addressed to the same set of officials. The only difference is that when Haman wrote his, he didn't address it to the Jews for obvious reasons. This one adds specifically that it was addressed to the Jews as well. Now, that might mean that he sent it to Jerusalem. They made sure that the copy of this was sent to Jerusalem, because you remember what's been going on in Jerusalem. This is in between. This is during those decades of time between the completion of the temple and when Ezra shows up. Ezra's not going to show up until 16 years later, after this. Ezra shows up in the narrative 16 years after these events, when Ahasuerus, or Xerxes' son, Artaxerxes, is on the throne. And so These are events back there in Jerusalem. You've still got the descendants of Zerubbabel. You've got Zechariah probably still preaching, perhaps even still preaching at this time, although he'd be really old by now. Back in Jerusalem. So as he sent it to the Jews, it might mean that he sent it there. However, that is still one of the provinces to which the original edict had been sent that Haman had written, because it went to all the provinces and to all the satraps, all the governors, and so on. So the Jews back there in Jerusalem had already been notified. They were also mourning and also expecting annihilation, also gearing up for their slaughter. They didn't know what to do about it because there was nothing they could do about it. It was ordered by the king. They didn't know what to make of this. I suspect that since they're mentioned first, I think what it actually means is that when he wrote this edict, he addressed it to all of the leaders of all, you know, all the various levels, the satraps, the heads over the major segments, then the governors over the smaller provinces, and then all of the regional leaders. They were all contacted and said, "This is the message. You get it to the Jews." The edict was written to address the Jews, and the responsibility of all of the, it was sent to all those leaders for their, and they were given responsibility for distribution to make sure that all the Jews in every province gets this word. As with Haman's edict, we are told that it was written in all the languages of the empire. This time it specifically names Hebrew as well, not mentioned in chapter 3. It says, according to their script and their language, which means it wasn't just written out in the Persian alphabet. They didn't transliterate into Persian and write it out. As we might. If any time I give you a Greek or Hebrew word in an outline, I put it in italics, I spell it with English letters. American, you know, our alphabet, the Phoenician alphabet that we're using. I don't do it with the Greek or the Hebrew alphabet. One of the things that's a peculiarity of Hebrew is it's written from right to left across the page, which is backwards from most languages, but it's written right to left across the page. So he's specifying this was written out in their own language, in their own script, so that they would see it and be able to read it. The documents were written with the various alphabets of the various people groups, not by transliteration. That document was then sealed with the king's signet. It was sealed with the king's signet. Now, the translation of in the King James of the last clause of verse 10 is radically different from the way it reads in the New American Standard. New American Standard, verse 10, says, "He wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds sired by the royal stud." Now, if you're reading the King James says, "sent letters by posts on horseback and riders on mules, camels, and young dromedaries." That's a pretty radical difference. The difference is not in the dispute over the Hebrew text. Everybody's translating exactly the same Hebrew words. The problem is, nobody knows for sure what those words mean, because a lot of those words show up only here. And so there's a lot of guesswork going on what those mean. The translators of the King James in their original preface said that there were passages like this that deal with where they said it, their phrasing was, we felt it better to say something than to say nothing. And so they would translate words they didn't know for sure what they meant. They go on to explain, particularly when it's talking about certain animals or gemstones, words that appear only once. We had to guess, and we're counting on later scholarship to help clear some of this up. If somebody comes along and has discovered what some of these words mean, I'm paraphrasing, but they explain all that in the preface of the King James Bible. Unfortunately, starting in the late 1800s, they quit publishing the King James Bible with the original preface, and so nobody's read it anymore in recent decades. They made their best guess. The problem is the typical word for mules, the typical words for camels, the typical word for dromedaries in the Hebrew don't show up in this. They're just guessing. What the King James translators assumed is that what Mordecai did here is, after he got this edict written, is he went out through the city and conscripted whatever animals might be used for transport to get them on their way quickly. And that may be what we're supposed to assume. However, more recent scholarship has done a little more study into the Hebrew and into the Persian, believes that rather than these words being words for different kinds of animals, they're technical terms for the specific horses that had been raised for the king, that were raised for speed and stamina, and were useful for couriers, and that Mordecai was able to commandeer those animals. He was able to use those animals rather than having to commandeer animals from the general population. The emphasis here is not on the haste with which he gathered up the animals on which the couriers were to ride. The emphasis is the speed with which the messages were delivered to the provinces, which argues for the latter interpretation. So as you read this, you say, wow, that's really different than the King James. I wonder what happened there. They're trying to make sense of words. They're not sure what the words mean. And it seems likely, most modern scholars believe that it's talking about especially swift horses that are bred for the king, and they're coming from the royal stables. The king had given Mordecai the authority to use them. So what is it that he's written, the content of this decree? Verses 11 and 12, its content. In them the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is, the month Adar. Well, as you read that, and many commentators get to this and they struggle over, I cannot believe that Mordecai would give the Jews then permission to annihilate the women and the children and to plunder their spoil. That just seems so bloodthirsty. Some say, well, it was just commensurate with the threat against them. They're going to give them the right to do what Haman had given them, their enemies, the right to do to them. Kind of an eye for an eye, equitable response. I would argue against that interpretation. I don't think that's the best way to understand this, because when we find at the end of the event, which is recorded in chapter 9, they don't, in fact, do any of that. They don't kill the women and children, and they don't confiscate anybody's property. It specifically says that they did not. And so I don't think we should read this as permission to do so. I think it's better to see that this is an intentionally parallel decree, so that everybody who hears this decree will understand the king changed his mind. They want everybody to understand, okay, the king said this, but he can't change the decree, but he did change his mind. Because they want them to make the connection with the earlier decree from Haman. And so there's a quote here. He uses the same verbs to destroy, to annihilate, and to kill. He uses those same three verbs for what they can do. And then let me put it this way. Let me explain it this way as I'm talking through for the outline's sake. First of all, it permits the Jews to assemble for their defense. Assuming the earlier edict, it seems that the earlier edict would permit their enemies to organize into armies of some size to sweep through a region and kill all the Jews. This gives the Jews the opportunity, the express opportunity, permission to organize, to gather together, to get ready to defend themselves. They're not left as individuals having to defend themselves against a mob or an army. They were able to organize to in a stronghold to provide for and for an organized armed defense. They were allowed to assemble for their defense. They could gather together to assemble. Secondly, they were permitted to take offensive action if attacked. They could destroy, kill, and annihilate all who attack them. The Jews are really not given permission to go out through the countryside as marauders to kill anybody who's ever said an ugly thing about them. That's what the earlier edict permitted the enemies of the Jews to do. But this doesn't permit the Jews to do that. They can gather together to defend themselves. Anybody who attacks, they have permission to use deadly force to defend themselves. You can kill anybody who comes up against you. Now, when it says, including children and women and to plunder their spoil, I don't think it's talking about what the Jews are permitted to do. It's talking about what the earlier edict said the enemies of the Jews could do. The Jews can organize to defend themselves from anybody who attacks them, intending to kill them, their women, their children, and take their stuff. It's using the language from that edict. Now the Jews are being given permission to defend themselves from such an attack. I don't think it's to permit them to do the same thing to their enemies, but to they're giving them the permission to defend themselves from those who would do such a thing to them. And it permits this defense for the entirety of the 13th day of the 12th month. Again, it's a 24-hour defense clause, as it were, because there's only a 24-hour attack clause. If they survive that 24 hours, the permission to kill the Jews is gone. It expires. It's only a one-day event, as this was originally intended. Permits their defense for the entirety of that day. So without canceling the earlier edict, ordering everyone to attack the Jews on that day and only that day, anybody who's listening to this edict understands that the king changed his mind. So now anybody who attacks the Jews at any time on that one day will be met with organized deadly force by order of the king. And so that decree is written and it's now being delivered. Verses 13 and 14, it's delivery. It's delivery. Verses 13 and 14. A copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the peoples so that the Jews would be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers, hastened and impelled by the king's command, went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out at the citadel in Susa. So first of all, note that this decree was preparatory. The whole point was so the Jews would be ready. So they'd be ready, as it's stated here. So the Jews would be ready for this day to avenge themselves and their enemies. Notice it was swift. They were hastened and impelled. I like the New International's rendering as it communicates pretty vigorously this idea. It says, the couriers riding the royal horses raced out, spurred on by the king's command. Okay, it helps communicate the urgency with which this was delivered. And then it was thorough. It was delivered to every province. It was published to all the peoples, and it was given out also at the citadel in Susa. Now, if you remember back in chapter 3, when the earlier edict that Haman had written was actually delivered and it was read out everywhere, do you remember what it says happened after that? How that chapter closes? Well, Haman and the king sat down to have drink. Haman, to celebrate his victory over the Jews, the king, apparently in anticipation of the money he's going to make that Haman's promised him for whatever was happening to annihilate all of these troublesome people that he's told me about. But it also closes by telling us that the city of Susa was in confusion. Everybody was puzzled, perplexed by what this vendetta against the Jews. Well, how was this pronouncement received? In verses 15 to 17, royal robes of blue and white with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews, there was light and gladness and joy and honor. In each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. This decree. So, this verse 15 is part of the reason I think all of this happened in a single day. The day, the night and the day following Esther's banquet, after which Haman was executed. Because in verse 15, Mordecai quickly identified as a grand vizier. And it seemed they went to bed with Haman as grand vizier. And they woke up with Haman impaled on a spike outside his own house. And Mordecai is grand vizier. And the city rejoiced. Says something about what they thought of Haman and of Mordecai. Mordecai was publicly identified as a grand vizier, and the city of Susa rejoiced. And that was repeated in the provinces. It says the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. The only one of those words on which I'll comment is the word light. It probably means the dark threat that had been hanging over their heads from the earlier decree. It's probably a reference to that. The gladness, the joy, and the honor are no surprise. and don't need much comment. It says there were feasts and holidays for the Jews throughout the empire in each and every city. Now, it might mean that the Jews had these feasts and celebrations for themselves, but the wording doesn't necessarily say that. It says that the feasts and holidays were for the Jews, not necessarily feasting and holidays held by the Jews. To me, the implication is at least there, that the possibility is there, that the entire kingdom rejoiced because of what was being done for the Jews, that this threat has been removed. The peoples of the land, then, says, it refers to the non-Jews. And so I'll borrow a term that won't come into common use until later for number five. I've given you four. There were feasts and holidays for the Jews. Number five, many Gentiles became Jews. Now, Gentile is a word that doesn't come into common use yet. Hasn't by Esther's day. Now, most commentators assume that these were false conversions that were made in fear of what the Jews might do to them on the 13th day of the 12th month. The word fear or dread that's used there, there's nothing else in the passage that would imply they were false conversions. It just says many of them became Jews. Then it says that the fear or the dread of the Jews had fallen upon them. This expression, I think, maybe ought to be understood differently. Instead of assuming this means they were terrified of what the Jews might do to them on that day, and so they wanted to sign up with them so they wouldn't get hurt on that day, understand that this is an expression that is quite frequently used for God in the Old Testament. He is frequently referred to as the fear or the dread of Abraham or of Isaac or of Jacob. And it's possible that this should be capitalized, and this would be the one time in all the book of Esther God's name appears, when he is called the dread of the Jews, or the fear of the Jews. You understand that the fear of the Lord is a good thing in Scripture? It's a positive quality? Here's what I think it means. I don't think we should capitalize it necessarily, but I believe what this means is that God worked in the hearts of many of the peoples of the land to bring them to faith in him. And they were converted as a result of what God did through Esther and Mordecai, that many were converted throughout the Persian Empire. Three lessons, and we'll close. Let me highlight just two or three things, from this text. First, again, one of the things that we see in Esther, an example of one who does what the New Testament calls redeeming the time. Or acts at the opportune moment. There's an illustration here, a reminder that whatever the risk, we should serve the Lord at opportune moments in life. Whatever the risk, we should serve the Lord at opportune moments. We should take that opportunity to serve the Lord. Don't know when it'll come again. As James puts it in James 4:17, to one who knows the right thing to do and does it not, to him it is sin. Well, Esther had an opportunity. It was profoundly risky, but she stepped out in a way nobody could have anticipated. Also see here another, I'll mention again, I've mentioned this before in this study, God will never abandon the Jews. The illustration that God will never abandon the Jews. Haman's friends told him, you know, oh, if Mordecai is a Jew and you've set yourself against Mordecai, well, you're doomed. That when they told him to build the scaffold, but only after. He knew he was in trouble at this point. He never abandoned the Jews. Even when in rebellion, they are still his people. Unless we should capitalize the dread of the Jews at the end of chapter 8. But we put it in Jonah 2, verse 9. Salvation is of the Lord. Mordecai couldn't engineer it. Esther couldn't engineer it. Only God could put the right people in the right place at the right time, give them the right opportunities. The salvation of the Gentile converts as well in all of this. It all comes by the hand of the Lord, just the way your salvation and mine is in him from before the foundation of the world, illustrated in the lives of the Jews in Esther's day. How you worked in the lives of your people in that day, in far less spectacular way.